Show.
Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I hope everybody's ready for a fabulous Thanksgiving feast tomorrow. It can be, do it the right way, and no matter what you're having, it's a fabulous Thanksgiving feast. And, of course, you know, we'll have a little bit of fun this evening. Got a couple of traditional things planned. The telling of the annual family, you know, if our progeny can extend out 400 or 500 years, this may be, you know, part of some sort of personal mythos. We'll go through the annual story of shopping for Thanksgiving dinner. Do that, a little reading, a little music. But one of my absolute favorite Thanksgiving things is this.
That in a very few moments there are going to be a lot of happy people out here. Now, the crowd is... curious, but well-behaved. And I think I hear something now. The crowd is moving out into the parking area. And, oh yes, I can see it now. It's a helicopter. And it's coming this way.
A helicopter?
It's flying something behind it. I can't quite make it out. It's a large banner, and it says, Happy Thanksgiving. W-K-R-P. What a sight, ladies and gentlemen. What a sight. The copter seems to be circling the parking area now. I guess it's looking for a place to land. No, something just came out of the back of the helicopter. It's a dark object. Perhaps a skydiver. Plummeting to the earth, only 2,000 feet in the air. The third. It's no parachutes yet.
Happy skydivers. I can't tell just yet what they are, but...
Oh, my God, they're talking! Oh, God, can you get this? Oh, they're crashing to the earth right in front of our eyes. They just went through the windshield of a parked car. It is terrible.
They're just running around pushing each other.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, the humanity. People are running about. The turkeys are hitting the ground like sacks of wet cement. I don't know how much longer the crowd is running for their lives. I think I'm going to step inside. I can't stay out here and watch this anymore. No, I can't go in there.
Lass, are you there? Lass isn't there. Thanks for that on-the-spot report, Lass. You just tuned in. The Pinedale Shopping Mall has just been bombed with live turkeys. Film at 11.
Oh, how I love that little moment. They're falling like bags of wet cement. And thanks to our pal Dookie over at morningconstitution.com for finding that and embedding it so I would remember it this Wednesday before Thanksgiving. I just love that. It's so believable in the world of smallish market radio. But yeah, it's the night before Thanksgiving. Be curious to find out. Is it all just turkey and dressing? Are there any particular special recipes that are involved? Feel free to share over the course of the evening if you wish. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. And, of course, locally or on your own nickel, 304-658-3333. And all of those roll right into the same magic telephone box here in the studio. And an email comes into bob@headonradio.com. And I, well, you know, it's going to be we're going to be pretty silent for the next, Thursday, Friday. Yeah. We got 4 days of silence here, notwithstanding the weekend programming. So make the most of it. Then let me just start out the evening. You know, I try to thank ever so many of the people who are involved with the process of getting the horn out to people at the end of the show. Let me start the program this evening by thanking them right up front. From Peter Godbold, who makes our computers behave themselves, to John Fox, who is the answer to all audio hysterics on my part, to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org, the man about whom there's little that can really be said because of the breadth and depth of everything that he does. Not just for this network, but to make liberal radio happen on the Internet in general. Ben Birch, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, who is still recovering from a busted foot. We're thinking of you. And ELO, Sue, the chat room moderator, video producer, Horn Den Mother, and all around couldn't get along without her. The hosts, Guy, Mark, myself, Billy Shears, Rick Goodner, Rick Smith, John Fox, everyone who has made the horn what it is in the past, and maybe again in the future, folks like Joe Vecchio, Bruce Birch. There is just, this is such an extraordinary undertaking that it boggles my mind even to contemplate it. And when we talk about something like Thanksgiving, even I, who don't go in for traditional organized religion, I can still be thankful. I can be thankful for the lovely little family that I have, that no matter how hard it gets or the depth of the trials and tribulations, we're trying to teach to stick together. I can be grateful for a wonderful, wonderful wife in Agnes. I can be grateful for the friends who surround us. I can be grateful for the people at Coal River Mountain Watch. I can be thankful for them because the efforts that are ongoing to save this region are monumental. And I don't know if I would have the starch to stand up to what they have stood up to over the years. So many things to be thankful for. And I'm so thankful for you who listen to the programs, who share your thoughts with me and with the other hosts. Unlike right-wing radio, we don't maintain some notion here that we have the answers and that you are to dutifully listen, absorb, and move on. If you listen to these programs over any extended period of time, you'll find out that most of the answers don't come from the hosts. Most of the answers come from the people who share their time with us, you. And for that, before we carve the bird tomorrow, we will go over, each of us, what we are thankful for. And you will be high on that list. So there is indeed much to be thankful for. But heaven knows there is much to be thankful for in the fact that there are only 54 days left of the long night that has been George Bush Dick Cheney, and the rest of that miserable, ugly, bloodthirsty crowd. So much to be thankful for. And I hope it is the same for you. I hope you can look around and realize that no matter how frustrating things may get, we have each other. And in having each other, we are, as the line from, It's a Wonderful Life goes, the richest folks in town. So there, you know, thank you. And know that you are remembered, that you are appreciated, that you are valued, that you are indeed loved. And it will be our Thanksgiving wish that you can recognize it, appreciate it, and revel in it. All right, so that's that. It's about 11 minutes past the hour, and no, I do have some fun stuff planned, a little storytelling thing later, as well as a piece of literature that I like to read every night before Thanksgiving. It's actually supposedly a Christmas story, but it is so much of this time of the year, and it is beautiful beyond words. So we'll do that. You know, we all like a sense of ritual here and there. But I suppose the top of the news should be, well, wait a minute, one more giggle before we get serious. Is that okay? Let's do.
Here on Thanksgiving, we done decided to let young Billy here tell you what he's thankful for. Billy?
I'm thankful for my mom, my dad. I'm thankful this is the last Thanksgiving that George W. Bush will be president. I'm thankful that he has less than 2 months left to mess up the country.
Security? We'll see how thankful you are in Guantanamo Bay, kid.
I'm thankful Barack Obama said he'll close Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah. But it is a tough day today. It is a painful day. The scenes from Mumbai in India are a horror. And I found, the reporting is, as usual, out of a chaotic situation like this. Not what you would hope to have. But it is still a developing situation. Gunmen have taken over the Taj Mahal Hotel and the Hotel Oberoi, I don't know, holding hostages on multiple floors. Flames and smoke have poured out of the Taj Hotel. The military have entered the Oberoi's building. Shortly after they did so, a huge explosion was heard. Another hostage situation is unfolding at Kama Hospital in India. One witness told local reporters in India that gunmen tried to find people with U.S. or British passports and took about 15 of them hostages. A CNN anchor staying at the Taj Hotel with a CNN crew says that about half the hotel's guests were Westerners. 9 sites were hit. Gunmen with automatic weapons and grenades. Hotels, a cafe, a hospital, a train station. All with great coordination. And, you know, while it hasn't been high on, it has been high on the world's radar. It's just that Attention Deficit Disorder America hasn't much paid attention to it, you know, because it's those people. There have been other violent acts in India recently. There's nothing in this to say nothing in this to answer the who done it part of this horror story. All the targets are businesses frequented by international visitors. Mumbai is the financial center of India. And there's nothing right now to point to who, like I said, who done it. But I can... I'm going to do one little bit of speculation here. India really is, as opposed to what we call ourselves, India really is a democracy. The United States, and then, oh, see, he don't love America. The United States is not a democracy. The United States is technically a republic, a union, if you will. They are much closer to the actual term democracy in India. And one can imagine, there are plenty of people, there's plenty of bad feelings. The Pakistanis hate the Indians hate the Pakistanis. Indian groups within India hate other Indians. The Hindus don't like the Muslims. A couple of years ago, the Jainists, you know, the people that won't swat a mosquito, were firebombing other people's restaurants because they served meat there and it was too near, they deemed, to a Jainist temple. This is 2008. This is waning 2008. And we still haven't quite gotten to that futuristic wonderland that many of us continue to hope for. The frustrations of people who bomb, who gun down unarmed innocents, it is still seen as entirely too valid by entirely too many people. And we'll just see what happens as this story develops. It is heartrending as it stands. The Maharashtra state government, where Mumbai is, said 78 people have been killed and about 200 wounded. The police themselves have confirmed 26 deaths. The scene of one of the attacks, as it appears on one of the websites, is sickening. Maybe Joe Biden, remember how the right wing made such fun of him, saying that there would be tests? Well, maybe this is one of them. Maybe, indeed, this is one of them. You'd like to have more information, but more information simply isn't forthcoming at this time. Reporting is a casualty in situations such as this. And, you know, I mentioned it last night on the program, but I can't help but think of it again now. Glenn Beck. I know, it seems odd, but just work with me here. I'll tie this together. Glenn Beck, on his program, yesterday, cheerfully and blithely raised the specter of something that should still be a horror in this country. And so far, really, there's just not that much in the way of backlash.
So the question is, do states have the right to secede anymore? Do states have the right to, because it was a compact, it's not perpetual. In fact, in Declaration of Independence, it says it is our right, it is our responsibility to get away from a government that doesn't listen to us anymore.
I hate this man. And I don't like using a word like that the night before Thanksgiving or any other day. But I utterly, completely loathe and despise Glenn Beck. That first line. So the question is, do states have the right to secede anymore? Well, doesn't that indicate that that's a phony question in the first place, anymore? When did states have the right to secede? As I said last night, and I reiterate today, that question was answered. And it was, and the answer to that question was written, inscribed on our national character in blood. No, the states do not have the right to secede. What does this freak want to secede over? He wants to secede over, now stop that. Not over domestic spying or torture or Guantanamo. Remember, this is a guy who sat behind the microphone and declared that he could gleefully strangle Michael Moore to death without a problem. Yeah, he's another one of those followers of a religion of peace. He's one of those magic underwear guys. Do states have the right to secede anymore? I wonder who all could answer that question. You think Ulysses Grant could answer that question? Do you think Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain could answer that question? Do you think James Longstreet could answer that question? Thomas J. Jackson? There was an awful lot of blood. Remember, one of the earliest casualties of the Civil War, general by the name of Albert Sidney Johnston, who took a ball in his leg and bled to death into his boot at Shiloh because he insisted that the doctors, such as they were, go and treat the wounded Northerners. You think he could answer that question for Glenn Beck? Do states have the right to secede anymore? It was a compact. It's not perpetual. See, the reason I linked the previous story and this together is that you get things like what happened in India out of things like Glenn Beck is saying. Am I arguing that Glenn Beck's speech should be suppressed? Oh, no. No, no, no. The worst thing in the world, however, is to just let that speech float out there unrebutted. And that's the problem with right-wing hate radio. Now, this program, I'll have a conversation with anybody. I really will. Agnes hates it when I'm away from the mic for a while because pretty soon I start talking to trees, walls, ceiling, the cat. I'll have a discussion with anybody about it, just about any topic. But the right wing doesn't want to do that. They just want to plant the seed, as Beck has done, just plant the seed of the idea of secession. And, of course, how interesting it is that secession would be spoken of by somebody like Glenn Beck, who, after all, is a slavish servant of the party that argues for that hateful old phrase, States' rights. Indeed. But bombs go off, children die, non-combatants in general die. Societies are cast into complete upheaval because of talk like Glenn Beck's. And, well, let's go on. Let's just finish this off real quick.
Do you even have a right to do that as a state anymore?
Where's this anymore come from? This anymore business? You know, on the one hand, the Republican Party nominated as their vice presidential candidate a woman who is still married to a man who is part of a political party in Alaska that, again, has as its the central tenet of its raison d'être, pardon my French, secession. The secession of Alaska from the United States. In fact, secessionist voters in Alaska cost Ted Stevens the election this past time through. Go look at the numbers. There were just enough secessionist Alaska Independence Party votes to edge soon-to-be Senator Begich into office. And from a historical perspective, those of you who think that the idea of secession was invented in the South, thanks for playing. Here's your lovely parting gift. Go home and wait for your year's supply of Rice-A-Roni. Among others to do it, well, the earliest states to talk about secession was, do you know the answer to this one? New Hampshire. New Hampshire wanted to secede from the Union long before anybody in South Carolina ever started talking about it. This was in the earliest part of the career of one Daniel Webster. And it was commercially motivated, and New Hampshire was all aflame with the idea of getting out of the Union. Didn't like it anymore, don't want to play anymore, we're just going to go and be something else. Yeah, Southerners didn't invent that idea. Sorry. But it's been bandied about from time to time, and it got bandied about enough just past the midway point of the 19th century that we went ahead and had a national bloodletting over it. And I'm enough of a history geek, I suppose, that I think the word secession is a dirty word. It's a vile word. It's a hateful word, and it's freighted with blood and gory death. And Glenn Beck wants to urge states to secede from the Union over the Wall Street bailouts. Glenn Beck would just as soon see another Shiloh, another Antietam, another Fredericksburg, another Gettysburg, another wilderness campaign, another 7 days, another peninsula. He would just as soon see all of that over the Wall Street bailout. Because you see, that's how right-wingers are. At the core, they hate. They don't dislike or disagree. They hate the government as it is currently constituted. They want a government that is some sort of weird theocracy, autocracy, where the minority has no rights. And they're willing to advocate for it. Do you even have a right to do that as a state anymore? What a fool he is. You know, if the right to if one's compensation was based on one's merit, or more yet, one's intelligence, Glenn Beck would be a pauper.
Do you have the right to say, you know what, you guys are going down a path that I don't even agree with?
That's simply astonishing. Positively stunning. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob.
Hey, Bob. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too. We're going to have a good one here. But I listened, and I was appalled. A friend of mine, a pretty good friend, too, from many, many years, told me today, and his sister is buying her husband, his brother-in-law, a 50 caliber machine gun for Christmas. My God, Bob. A 50 caliber machine gun And I asked him, why? He said, for the Obama factor. The Obama factor.
What?
True. Truth. Bob, you don't...
Oh, no, I'm not doubting you. That was more of a... Oh, jeez.
A 50 caliber machine gun. For Christmas, my God, I said, what?
Well, you know, there's nothing like a 50 caliber machine gun to celebrate the birth of the Prince of Peace.
Yes, absolutely, Bob. But, hey, these, my God, I've known this man for many, many more years than I've known you. I knew his mother before she died. I knew Olga, okay? I knew her, and she was a wonderful lady. But she wasn't one of those, I didn't think. But, my God, her daughter is buying her you know, buying her husband a 50 caliber machine gun for the Obama factor, because guess what? They're coming to get you. Bob, please.
We're talking about a friend in North Dakota there with you, yeah. Right?
Yes. Well, yeah, he's not with me, but yeah, he is my friend. I've fished with the man.
Geographically nearby.
I have fished with him. I've sat on a riverbank and caught fish side by side with him, okay? And I know the man. I know him personally, and I love him. I do, because he's a dear friend. He really is a dear friend. But his sister, because, well, hey, he told me, hey, Bob, he says, but hey, they're rich. He says, they got lots of money, and that's why. And I says, how much is she spending for this 50 caliber machine gun? $14,000, he says. I says, $14,000? He says, yeah, $14,000. And I says, Bob, and I'm not talking to you or to me. I'm talking to him, my friend Bob. I told him, I said, Bob, why doesn't she take $14,000 and donate it to the Red Cross or to, the Salvation Army? They can do much more good with it than he can with a 50 caliber machine gun. Yeah, but he says they got lots of money, and they're afraid somebody's going to come and take it from them. See, that's the thing. Everybody's afraid somebody's going to come and get something. I said, Bob, just...
But that's the point, Bob. What could this guy possibly have that us liberals want?
No, it isn't us liberals, Bob. They're afraid of themselves. They're afraid to look each other in the eye and say, what are we doing? Why are we this way? What is our problem? They can't even ask themselves what their problem is. They don't understand the fact that I don't hate Bob Kincaid from West by God, Virginia. And guess what? Bob Kincaid doesn't hate Bob Mattson from North by God, North Dakota. You know what I mean?
Right. And now that her mouth is wired shut, I don't even hate Ann Coulter.
No, hey, Bob, I never hated her. I just thought...
I just wanted a big piano to drop on her head. That's
well, no, I did not hate her. I never wanted a big piano to fall on her head. I didn't want anything bad to happen to Ann Coulter, because I figured it this way. She would do it to herself. Anyone that stupid will do it to themselves just as surely as my friend's sister is doing to her husband by buying him a 50 caliber machine gun. That's beyond stupidity, Bob. It is that thing that every one of us that cares about our neighbor understands. It's that thing that willful ignorance. They do not want to see anything except whatever it is they believe in.
And well,
you know, the question I've got, though, Bob, is, you know, are these wingers, are these wingnuts actually ready to start shooting?
Yep. Hey.
They are?
They're ready to kill anybody that gets in their way. I believe they are. I mean, my God, I'm not that way, and neither are the people. I mean, even this brother of the sister is not. I mean, he is a friend of mine, Bob. I've fished with the man. I've sat on a riverbank.
I know, and you just want to look over and go, who the hell are you? And what have you done with my friend?
No. Bob, you got to understand my friend, Bob. He was as bewildered as you and I are. He was as bewildered as you and I are. Who are these people, and where did they come from? What makes them think that we are the enemy? Bob, I'm not your enemy. I'm your brother. I'm the same as your father.
I know, but, you know, if you let this stuff get out of hand, Bob, some of us still remember, not remember, but have been taught the lessons of the Civil War. Fathers sat behind rail fences and shot at sons.
I know, Bob. But we, you and I, we're not rebels. I heard that when you were talking about state rights, okay?
Yeah.
And I thought, what are states' rights? What are they, Bob?
Well, states' rights, Bob, are that's the code word that right-wingers use whenever they get caught trying to discriminate or otherwise put down someone with whom they do not agree.
Ah, that's the Obama factor then. Yeah? Because that man just happens to be a black man. He going to take over my White House? I don't think so. See, now we got to get another Civil War going, so let's get us a 50 caliber machine gun.
You know, I got an email in, and it was just the subject line just said, "And it begins."
And no.
No, wait, Bob. It says the subject line just says, "And it begins." And it's a photograph of the presidential limousine, you know, big old long black Cadillac.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sitting there in front of the tidal basin across from the Jefferson Memorial. You know where I'm talking about.
Yep.
And it's on the cobblestones there, and it's been photoshopped.
Mm-hmm.
And it's had a great big old pair of giant tires with big old chrome rims and inserts photoshopped onto it.
Okay.
And hence the subject line of the email, "And it begins." And this is where these people want to go. This is where the secessionists like Glenn Beck want to go. This is where they're not. I'm convinced at this point in time, Bob, that and I don't have a problem using the word now. The secessionist right wing. Dear God, it's 2008, and I'm using a word like secessionist to talk about another American. Oh God, the secessionist right wing wants to get it started again.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Okay. In 2000, when George W. Bush stole the election, okay, how many of us left-wingers, okay, us horrible liberals, how many of us went out and bought 50-caliber machine guns to protect ourselves from George W. Bush? Please, I mean, just, you can find that easily. Just ask yourself, did you, did I, did anybody that's ever been associated with the head-on radio network go out and buy a 50-caliber machine gun to protect themselves from George W. Bush?
Well, no. No, because he's white like me.
No. You will find that was zero, Bob, because
sure.
we don't hate our neighbors, nor do we fear our neighbors. We don't fear Osama bin Laden. We don't fear them because we're not.
I fear a damn coal truck a hell of a lot more than I fear Osama bin Laden, Bob.
There you go. Yeah. There are people in the mountains that are afraid of log trucks, too, coming down them logging trucks, and they wonder, do they got brakes?
Because the mountaintop removers here in West Virginia have killed a whole lot more West Virginians than Osama bin Laden's ever even thought about.
I know, but think about it for one moment. Which liberal person was it, Elo, did she think about, you know, going out and buying a 50 caliber? I doubt it.
Okay. No, that's not, but that's because we have these things in our heads called brains, and we actually use them to think with. They're not sitting, it's not just insulation for the empty space in our skulls between our ears.
Bob, my friend, my dear friend, and I mean that seriously, I really do, right down to the pit of my soul. I love you folks. I care about you. I think about, you know, the mountaintop removal at Massey and the, you know, all that ugliness has to stop. And the ugliness stops when you stop thinking that way. And we have to teach our children, Bob. All of our children. No, not, hey, I'm past the point. I don't even care what they taught in the past. And I don't care about secessionists. Because guess what? If they secede from the Union, the United States of America, has been pretty much destroyed. It has been, Bob. The Constitution has been just wiped out by George Bush using it as toilet paper. It's a fact. Now, let's realize that and say, okay, it's enough, okay? On this Thanksgiving, I am thankful. I am still thankful that I got, hey, this opportunity to speak, because, hey, it may not mean anything to anybody other than those that listen to us liberals, because I'm not a pacifist, Bob. I don't believe in just lying down and letting it happen to you. I believe that we liberal folk, okay, we, the same guys that went up on that mountain there in West Virginia, and they organized, they unionized, they became brothers and sisters, and most of them are underground today, buried in the earth, because they were unionists. They believed that the Union was not the United States of America, but the Union of what is called United Mine Workers, okay, and United Auto Workers, what was that other one with the boys with the trucks? They called themselves what?
Teamsters.
Teamsters, yeah. They were a part of a team, Bob. And we, the people, need... I mean, I'm not talking about the ones that go out and buy 50 caliber machine guns for their loved one for Christmas because they're afraid of Obama. Obama is our team. He's the leader of our team. And if we give him the chance and not have to worry about somebody with a 50 caliber machine gun attacking his motorcade as he's ascending to the presidency, as George Bush was afraid of people with eggs. And what was that they threw at him, eggs and snowballs? Yeah?
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
Eggs and snowballs, and they had to shut down the parade route, and they didn't even walk. They ran. I mean, they drove. Like, oh, my God, they're throwing eggs at us. And snowballs.
Well, you know George Bush will, exit the White House out the back door.
I don't care.
I mean, I'm not kidding. He will. He will. He'll sneak away.
He can leave like me.
Because there's not going to be anybody there to cheer him.
Anyway, think about it for a moment, folks. All of you, all of my loved ones, and I mean that to the Kincaids and to every other human being on this planet. Think about it. My loved ones, because I do care about you, but I will not lie down and listen to this drac, this garbage that they keep spewing out on the internets, and they keep spewing it out on the mainstream media, and they keep spewing it out over and over again about, oh, yeah, it's the unions that are destroying you. No, it's the ununionists, those that do not want us united. And those like, what do you call them, Glenn Beck, that said, we need states' rights. No, we need to unionize and become one united planet, not United States, one united planet against what the, okay, call them neo-Nazis, neo-Republicans. The truth is, I listened to Mike Malloy last night and I wept. I heard a woman talk about her husband who had moved from their home, was over 2 hours away driving in Michigan, and he had taken a job and she was living in the car because they had to give up their home. And I don't know how many people listen to Mike Malloy, but when I heard that, I was baking. I was baking a pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving, and I was watching it in the oven. And when I heard her voice tell of how the children were staying with Grandma, and they could not go back because they didn't have enough gasoline in their car to drive home for Thanksgiving. And there were two liberal voices that came on after she had told her story to offer her and her husband the petrol so they could drive home and give them enough money so that he could get back to be on the job on Friday so he could receive his first paycheck since they lost their home, their middle class status, had to leave their children with Grandma so that they'd have a home in their hometown so they could send them to the schools that they had been used to going to while Mommy and Daddy went and looked for a job in another city 2 hours away from where they lived because the bank had foreclosed on their home and they didn't have jobs. So, Bob, I wept. I cried like a baby. I sat in front of my oven watching that pumpkin pie rise and tears streamed down my face and I screamed out, oh my God, why have you forsaken us? And then I said, it wasn't God that forsaked us. It was the Republicans, and they have always forsaken us, the people.
Bob, you know what? You know, you remind me of something. And that is a statement that came out, what, from that little freak Grover Norquist, the guy who said he wanted to drown America's government in a bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, see, the Democrats got control of Congress in 2006, and that's why the economy's the way it is. And you know what? Maybe we don't do a good enough job of just reminding people, this is what happens when you get 8 years of Republican rule.
No, it's been more than 8 months.
No, but that's not. But some of this, not to this extent, because the dim leader's daddy wasn't quite as evil and stupid and pig-eyed and mean as his son. But this kind of stuff was happening at the end of the other Bush administration too. It always happens at the end of Republican administrations. It happened at the end of Hoover's. Okay.
Yes.
It happened at the end of Reagan's and Bush's. It's happening at the end of W's. This is what they do. This is their stock in trade. This is their job. This is their purpose in life, is destroying this country.
No, Bob.
No, it is, Bob.
Stock in life is destroying that tie that binds. That tie that binds you and I and what was that, John Fox down there in Australia. Okay? Bob, are you gone?
I'm right here.
Oh, that tie that binds, that love that makes us brothers, that makes us care about our neighbor, that is their mission. It has nothing to do with, you know, just breaking down the economy. It means to destroy humanity. That is evil, Bob.
Yes, it is. Because they are.
Love does not destroy. Love creates. Hate and evil destroys. And guess what? Republicans, Republicans, neo-Nazis, Adolf Hitler, Mussolini, George W. Bush, Patty Bush, Nixon, and what was that other ugly SOB that I hate? Oh, yeah, Kissinger, the messenger of death. He came to this planet to do one
purely thing. A war criminal, pure and simple.
Take away the love of humanity, one for another, neighbor for neighbor. That, oh, you used to talk about that, Bob. You say, this is the front porch, and, hey, you just come by the front porch and say, hey, Bob, how you doing? And come on up here and have some a cold cup of buttermilk. You know, hey, or Dave, I can get some of that there, what do you call that up there in them mountains?
A little shine.
It's a little bit of that shine. Hey, me and Pappy will go out here and have a sip of shine. But, hey, for the kids, we got buttermilk, okay? But you'd have your neighbor over, and you cared about them.
Sure,
and
sure.
That's the front porch, and that's the head-on network. You're still the front porch. And by
we're
God,
trying, man, we're trying, Bob. We are trying.
I know, and as long as I can still connect with you, I still feel connected, and I do care.
Well, and we know you do, and we're glad you do stay connected. And I tell you what, I'm sure that Glenda will do her usual wonderful job with the dinner tomorrow. And I'd love to be there, Bob. And I tell you what, turkey being turkey, everybody be napping about an hour after dinner. You take care, Bob, and give our best to the family. And a very happy Thanksgiving to you.
Love to you and to your family and to this earth and to all loving people that care about their neighbor. I don't care what your religion, what your faith, what your thoughts are on this day. Let's be thankful for one thing, Bob, each other.
Here, here.
And I am thankful for you. And, hey, you just give that girlfriend of yours a big old smooch from Bob and say, hey, this is from that old...
I will convey that specifically to the redheaded Hellcat.
That old wore-out warrior up there in the High Plains, he don't know what he's talking about, but by God, he loves you, girl.
All right, you take care, Bob. We'll talk soon.
Bye.
Right, bye now. Up on the high plains, our buddy Bob. Email rolling in relative to some of this. Cindy asked the question regarding the hunger reports that are going around. What's the new number, 30 million people, or it may top 30 million people accessing food stamps? And I've seen that a couple of times today. She says, something's bothering me about these reports. They're running on the news congruently with local stories of gun shows selling tons of guns at marked-up prices that are flying off the shelves. How is it possible that everyone can afford these guns and no food? What's going on? Can we get some insight into this story? We're talking about different groups of people. The Obama factor, as Bob mentioned, is a very, very real marketing ploy. And it is being used to scare, you know, ignorant people into going and wasting their money on guns instead of on the things that really matter. It is a marketing ploy, pure and simple. It is a means of separating people from their money and focusing them away from that which matters. Kind of reminds me of this.
By the way, if anyone here is in marketing or advertising, kill yourself. Thank you. Just planting seeds. Planting seeds is all I'm doing. No joke here. Really, seriously, kill yourself. You are no rationalization for what you do. You are Satan's little helpers. Kill yourself, kill yourself, kill yourself now. Now, back to the show.
Yeah, the late, great Bill Hicks. True, that. Because that's what the Obama, there is no Obama factor. There's an O'Reilly factor, and it's a weird little twisted right-wing hate fest on Fox, the Fox phony news channel. But the NRA has declared that there is an Obama factor, and Obama wants to get your guns. Do you understand that the National Republican Rifle Association, and I'm not making these words up, the NRA has declared President-elect Barack Obama an enemy. An enemy. Not an opponent. Not someone with whom they have a disagreement. The National Rifle Association has declared Barack Obama an enemy of your gun rights. Where I come from, that's pretty doggone strong language. If somebody is your enemy, what's it okay to do? You know the answer. You know, if you go into the Head On Radio Network chat room, you will see a little countdown timer there. Time left in President Bush's terms, 54 days, 17 hours, 1 minute, 26 seconds. And by the way, those of you listening who are in the chat room can time the latency of the program getting to you by the time I just mentioned. Neat, huh? But we sit in the chat room and we talk about the merciful end of the Bush administration presidency. And we talk about a day when the darkness will lift. When the ignorant conservative curtain will be lifted from across the face of this once great nation. But we don't talk in terms of enemy. Sure, we've referred to George Bush as a moron, because he behaves like a moron. Sure. We have referred to him as a warmonger, because he is. Because his actions have reflected that appellation. But we do not use the eliminationist rhetoric of the right and start calling people an enemy. This report over at Think Progress notes that they visited the nation's gun show in Chantilly, Virginia, where 1,000 vendors took over a building the size of 2 football fields. The advertisement for this gathering in the Washington Post said in big, bold capital letters,
Get your guns while you still can. It is a marketing ploy. It is an evil marketing ploy. It is, at the end of the day, a marketing ploy that has at its heart the very eliminationist rhetoric we have come to expect from the right wing. But I sense a broadening and a deepening of the undercurrent involved here. We now have a very well-paid right-winger to whom right-wingers listen for reasons that are quite beyond me, suggesting that it's time for states to secede from the Union. And you have terrified white people overrunning gun stores to buy firearms. Now, probably the prudent way to deal with this is, you know, leave them alone and they'll come home scraping their knuckles behind them. But it is hard for me to see this and not see at least a little glimpse of something very, very frightening. And I welcome your thoughts. By the way, in response to my culinary query, Thanksgiving tradition, Marty chimes in and says, before she died, my grandmother used to make potato salad that we were convinced could make millions. The only problem was none of us could copy what she did. Isn't that always the way? We all tried. We watched. We tried to emulate her. We just couldn't do it. Make store-bought or anybody else's potato salad bland in comparison. Careful, I may start power salivating at the mere thought. Marty says, P.S., I don't consider Thanksgiving a theocratic holiday. After all, you don't hear the O'Reillys of the world whining about the war on Thanksgiving. Well, that's one of the reasons I like it, Marty. Because you can be thankful to those around you who make your life good and your life decent. And you don't have to play the parlor games and carnival huckster con games of the organized religion industry to simply sit down and consecrate a special dinner to the honor and the love of those around you and the memories of those who have gone before. So chime in if you want to. Area code 304-658-3333 or 877-443-2366. This is America's liberal voice. This is The Horn. Happy Thanksgiving, y'all.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Coming up on 10 minutes past the hour, and let's go right to the phones. Let's see. We have Preston calling from Denver. Hey, Preston, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. Thanks. Happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving to you, too, sir.
Well, I just wanted to wanted to follow up on something I mentioned a week or two ago. I contacted Frank and Angel.
Mm. Yes.
And, so I think she's working on something, so... Hopefully you'll get something, an email.
Very cool. Very, very, very cool. That's wonderful. That's a great initiative on your part. Thank you very much.
And what else? Where are you going to be doing this tomorrow?
Well, we've got we've started some baking. Of course, once a year, and the whole family looks at me every time every Thanksgiving. Why don't we have this more often? I make, you know, the Thanksgiving Day dressing. We don't stuff the turkey. We just bake the dressing with some nice broth and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, very, 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 very traditional fare. The turkey dressing, mashed potatoes, sweet potato croquettes, little cranberry sauce on the side. I hear Texas Betsy has a fabulous recipe for a cranberry relish that's a nice sort of change of pace, but she didn't get the recipe to me quick enough.
Okay.
And then sweet potato pie. Decided I'd do something different. Go with sweet potato pie instead of pumpkin pie for dessert, and a pecan pie and a key lime pie.
Sounds wonderful.
I love the pies. I'm a pie guy.
Great, great. Yeah, actually, I was finishing up apple pie just today. Now that you mention it.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. What else? I wanted to ask you if you caught Tom Hartman's show recently. He had someone on from the Ayn Rand Institute.
Oh, no, no, he didn't. Well, you know, yeah, Tom doesn't hesitate to go head-to-head with those
that's
types.
That's right. And they were debating whether or not high-sugar foods and fast food should have the should be able to advertise and market to children like they do. And the Ayn Rand guy said, oh, yeah, definitely. It's a free speech issue. And also, hey, he kept saying, you don't want the government to decide what you should and shouldn't eat, do you? And it was very kind of sneaky. He changed the argument from a debate about the media and who should control it and be able to use it to, you don't want the government to decide what you can and can't eat.
Yeah, but, well, but see, that's what they do, Preston, because they have so thoroughly trained this country. I mean, we're like, not we, not you, not I, not this audience, but so many people in this country are like Pavlov's dog salivating when the bell rings, when they hear some right-winger say, the government, and this goes all the way back to Ronald Reagan and pre his presidency, that BS line about the most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government, and I'm here to help.
Yeah, they don't say that when they're talking about the NSA and the CIA and the FBI.
Oh, no. And then the Wall Street boys don't say it when they're talking about a bailout.
Right. Well, I would say, though, I'd include myself in those, I certainly have had my Pavlovian moments. I'm kind of constantly digging myself out from them all the time because it's, hurled at us.
But you're conscious of it, Preston. That gives you a fighting chance.
Yeah, and I think there are a lot more people becoming that way. There are so many projects. I mean, if I was looking at it from, like, say, the standpoint of someone from the NSA who does intel on progressive movements, not necessarily to subvert them or destroy them, but just to do information gathering. They watch trends in society. It's their job. And I'm not saying it's necessarily a nefarious thing, but it's depending on who's doing it. But anyway, they look at progressive movements, they look at their media, what they're developing, and there's these, there's nothing like Air America just 10 years ago. There weren't shows like you. There wasn't an internet talk. There wasn't, alternative radio and Link TV and Dish.
No, it has blossomed in many ways. It's still got a long way to go, but it has blossomed.
Democracy Now, that's on 750 stations around the country. Some on TV, public TV, some on community access, and some on, public radio, college radio stations.
Yeah, sadly not on any radio here in West Virginia, Stan.
That's a shame. That's definitely a shame. I think as confused as people can be and, all these bigotries and, things that we pick up, still there's this other trend as well that I'm hoping overcomes it. There might be a tipping point in our favor. I think it's even getting to the point where many of the elite, there's kind of an intra-elite conflict going on. There are these fanatics who just want as much money as quickly as they can. They don't care what they do to the earth, all that stuff. They don't care what they do to our kids. They'll poison them. They make money. So what?
So what if the FDA can't isolate a tolerable level of melamine in an infant's system and call it safe? So what? Right. It's a little melamine in the baby formula. What's a baby here or there?
Yeah,
well, where,
yeah.
But I'm sorry, Preston. I'm not trying to be Mr. Negative. Where's the pro-life movement in the melamine in the baby formula issue?
Good question.
But see, not allowed to speak out on an issue like that because their masters in corporate America and the Ayn Rand types would scream them down and tell them, you're hating on capitalism and everybody knows Jesus is a capitalist. You don't hate Jesus, do you?
Right. Well, there are several organizations, though, say, like, I think there's one called Food and Water Watch. There's others that, public citizen does a lot of this kind of stuff.
Sure.
And in the moment, when they get more publicity themselves, I mean, they get focus on the family type publicity. It'll be remarkable. I mean, and if Obama allies himself with groups like this more publicly, he spoke at a Moms Rising convention 2 years ago, a wonderful parents group that works on maternity leave and paternity leave and paid sick days, support for families. And once progressives articulate that, the right wing is going to have a very hard time continuing their attacks. You know what I'm saying?
I do indeed. And what I hope this movement that propelled Barack Obama to office, Preston, what I hope will happen out of that is that people will see that there's one, that the this was a battle and not the war. Oh, see, look, there I go. See how it sneaks into your vocabulary?
Yeah.
I hate that. But this was a chapter and not the book.
Oh, well put. Yeah.
And that we still have work to do. Obama's got a job to do. Nancy Pelosi's got a job to do. Harry Reid's got a job to do, if you'll do it.
U.S. citizens have a job to do.
But we got a job to do.
Have a job to do. Teachers, yes, definitely. And wealthy people. I was talking about the kind of antisocial wealthy people, but there are progressive wealthy people. Groups like Responsible Wealth, Chuck Collins, Bill Gates' father, actually, has said a lot of very progressive things. I think people with Microsoft, I believe, or maybe Sun Microsystems, they've sunk in a lot of money fighting the war on non-corporate drugs and the injustices of that. In fact, they helped get Michigan this year was the state that passed, a medical marijuana initiative.
And Massachusetts decriminalized.
Oh, good, good. Huge issue. And that was another, more success for sure.
And, that's one of the things that was bothersome to a lot of people about the new attorney general appointee or nominee. He is virulently anti marijuana in any form whatsoever, and that includes the medical form.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
But with some of the misgivings of a lot of people in the progressive world or the liberal world about some of these people being nominated to Obama's cabinet, he had a very, I thought, appropriate remark to it today. Somebody asked him at a press conference about how he responded, what his response was to the misgivings being announced by the liberal or progressive side about some of his not exactly liberal nominees.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, as far as the Treasury and the economy are concerned, he said, I don't think people would be very pleased with me if I appointed people who had utterly no experience to come in and work on these issues. Okay, mm-hmm. I'll buy that. But the best part of it was when he said, Preston, he said, finally, though, I got put here to do a job. And it's my responsibility, and the buck stops here. It is my job to have the vision. It is my nominees and appointees' jobs to put that vision in place. And I'm hoping that it was what I took it to be, and that was just a gentle reminder that we are going to have a presidency that understands what George H.W. Bush once derided as the vision thing.
Yeah. Well, it would be interesting if he's able to do things like, say he'll make these appointments and leave some Republicans there. Keep Robert
looks
Gates
like
there.
Gates is going to stay now, I guess.
Yeah. But say on the banking and commerce end of it, have Wolfson and Lawrence Summers there, and then bring in people he knows, like the executives of a place like South Shore Bank in Chicago, which is a community bank that specializes in loans to the middle class and lower class people. And they also emphasize loans to businesses that are doing efficiency and conservation measures. And they're doing very well. They're very secure in what they're doing. They're not playing all these currency speculation games or hiding money off in the Bahamas. They're keeping it in their communities. They're being prudent, conservative with it, and just. And now they've got branches. They've got a branch in Cleveland, and I think in Oregon, and great stuff. And maybe those people can come in. And it was actually, I was speaking with Mark Levine earlier in his show before yours, and he talked about how the need just of people with different views meeting each other, sitting in on meetings or going to their churches or going to their parties or raves, whatever. It's a very radical act, overcoming the segregation that takes place in so many ways, physically and mentally, spiritually, politically. So anyway, Obama may or may not be able to do something like that, bring in South Shore people. You know, I think,
or if he has learned things from them, they don't necessarily have to physically be. It's kind of it's kind of like a raffle. You do not need to be present to win.
But
if that kind of thinking, those kind of ideas have influenced them, maybe they'll come to bear.
Yeah.
And right now, as frustrated as I got with the Eric Holder appointment, I'm sincerely trying to withhold judgment until I learn more, because I have to try to learn more.
It's an endless process. You know, speaking of political actions and political advocacy regarding the banking industry, somebody did that today on Randy Rhodes' show. She had a caller who called in, and I think she actually was in the private banking industry herself, but she prefaced her comment by saying, you know, I shouldn't say this because it goes against my own industry, but I have to tell you, people would be probably better off putting their money in their community banks and credit unions. And, again, for some of the reasons I cited.
And truth be told, you don't hear, you know, the government re-evaluated and added more names to its list of banks that are swirling at the top of the bowl right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Oddly enough, there's not a lot of credit unions on there.
Right.
Now, why would that be?
That's right.
Because the members own the credit union.
Yep.
And they tend to operate with a little bit more prudence.
Yep. Yep. And a lot more transparency. And, you know, a range of people have seats on the board and voting rights and all that stuff. It's democratic. And these, you know, the private banking industry is authoritarian. They're anti-democratic. They're tyrannies. And, doing a lot of damage for sure. But, again, there's a counter movement. As ugly as and reactionary as things get, there seems to be like a parallel counter movement. The micro banking, Grameen Bank, that's a global movement helping the poorest people of the world.
Yes.
These are life and death issues, people having access to their land and seeds and water. And,
they're the micro loans, you know, less than 100, sometimes less than $50. Absolutely turning a person's life around.
Yep. Often in the hands, not always, but oftentimes in the hands of the moms of the family. And come to think of it, the founder of the Grameen Bank, who won the Nobel Peace Prize a couple of years ago, which really irked the Western xenophobes, you know, Mohammed Yunus winning the prize. Mohammed. But
I know.
He advised South Shore Bank. They've worked together. And so these movements are not just, you know, what's going on here in the U.S., but there's a lot more interaction taking place than we recognize at times. It's not all us beaming, you know, emanating the democracy to others. It's coming our way from other sources. In fact, when Hugo Chavez said something about after Obama won, he said he was glad to see that a popular movement has spread. You know, we've had it going on here, and we're glad to see it develop there in your country. And people kind of took umbrage to that, but I think there was some truth to that. There's been a remarkable democracy movement in Venezuela and Bolivia. You know, I think it was wrong, although it was a great victory for the U.S., but I don't think to say this is the, I think Obama said this too, that this is the only country where something like this could happen, where this story could take place.
I know.
I think, you know.
Well, and that's another one of those language problems that comes across, Preston. We have deified the word democracy. And within the last 8 years and within the 12 years of Reagan and Bush 1, democracy was used to define, and certainly within the Nixon era as well, democracy was used to define any group that we liked that allowed people to have an election, whether it was dummied up or not. But democracy is a double-edged sword. Democracy is far and away not a guarantee of peace. Democracies are not necessarily peaceful nations, and this goes all the way back to the people who invented it. You know, yeah. The Athenians.
Yeah.
You could call them anything, but peaceful wasn't one of them.
And you could have, like, democratic-appearing forms, but not really a democratic substance to the society. For instance, like I think the term is polyarchy, where you have elites kind of setting the frames and making most of the decisions within certain boundaries, and then having popular ratification of what was crafted by elites. But there, again, in that field, you know, while democracies can turn into frauds and counterfeits and all sorts of dysfunctions, there are places where it really works and where it's being applied.
Well, it works. It works where people are actively involved in it. I mean, I'd love to see the Vermont town meeting format spread all across this country. You know, whether it's a little town in Vermont or whether it is a neighborhood group in Chicago or Dallas or whatever, and those individual votes move upward.
Yeah.
That couldn't help but be good. Now there are those critics, who call it, you know, rule by rabble, but still consensus has to be reached, and that can't help but be a benefit in any given community group in which it's practiced. Because the problem with autocracy or the problem with dictatorship is it's dependent on the quality of the dictator.
Yep. And that term rabble actually has an interesting history. It's usually invoked by the elite who fear. They fear and demean the rabble. I think one of the elite founders, maybe Madison, made a remark about the need to keep the rabble in line, and just a kind of a very negative view of the general public.
Alexander Hamilton despised ordinary working people.
Okay, yeah.
That mindset has always been present in this country, and to a certain extent, by virtue of the fact that so much of our law centers on property, they won.
Yeah.
If you see what I'm saying, you know, I'm not defined by property. I'm not defined by what I've got. I'm defined by what I am. But there are a lot of people in this country. Well, look here, got me a new rifle, and I got me a big screen TV, and I got defines the parameters of their world.
Yeah.
Whereas my idea of I got is, I got a community that's got substance to it. I've got schools that my children can go to and not be poisoned while they're trying to learn. You know, those are the kinds of I gots that matter to me.
Yes, you know, thoughtful teachers maybe in your kids' lives. You know, access to some healthy food and some healthy media.
Right. I mean, you're out in Colorado, Preston. How do you reckon conservative or liberal, progressive, either one, how do you think folks would feel if a big old company came in and started using about 3 million pounds per day of ammonium nitrate explosives, just like Timothy McVeigh used, and announced that they were going to level Pikes Peak?
Or Aspen or Vail?
Yeah. You know, because there was something under there that corporate America needs and wants, and what's, you know, that's our coal under your ground. Or gold or silver. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, Colorado was founded on some of that stuff. There's, you know, silver in their hills. And telluride and all that stuff.
That's right. It's a total outrage what's going on there. I'm happy to see, though, on Common Dreams over the past month, I've seen at least two articles on protests, especially some student protests, college students protesting.
Mm-hmm.
Coal River Mountain Watch was awarded. They received some recognition for their activism from, I'm not remembering, maybe.
Co-op USA was one,
yes.
I know.
Yes, that's it.
That's for the Coal River Mountain Wind Project. which is under dire threat right now. I spent the biggest part of the program last night talking about that, Preston. We need people to contact the governor of West Virginia. He has the power, you know, to rescind the permits that will allow the destruction of Coal River Mountain. They plan to go forward. Massey plans to go forward on its blasting and eliminate this last mountain that could be a bastion of clean, futuristic energy for the region. And we need the governor contacted as soon as his office opens back up.
You know, and we need people like, you know, our allies like Ed Schultz and Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann to reach the tipping point of people.
I mean, yes,
if they
absolutely.
Hold their about this issue, that would be enough people, I think, to stop it in its tracks. I really do.
I recognize. I don't have near the audience those folks do, and that by virtue of being more commercial, they can't afford to spend a program on it.
Right. I don't know if they.
So it would have to be something that the listeners created.
Yeah.
Create a momentum, a sense of momentum to spend time on the issue.
Yeah, drop that thought meme that people add busters, I think. Use that word M-E-M-E.
Yes.
Like dropping the thought out there. Well, like that caller, that woman about the banks who talked about, you know, community banks, credit unions. I'm sure, you know, the private banking industry is always monitoring media and, you know, just always trying to do the best public relations and countering, you know, stuff that besmirches their images. I'm sure they were just cringing when they heard that person recommend credit unions, you know, their competition.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And again, moments like that is what we can do all the time in our daily lives. You know, when we're arguing with a right-wing person or something and we seem to be kind of spinning our wheels, there are these totally other angles we can come at things with. You know, I mean, Rush Limbaugh has not told them yet what to think about credit unions, so you can encourage them. He hasn't spent a lot of time attacking organic food or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Other arguments that, you know.
But, you know, that all falls under what Don Blankenship referred to us as greeniacs. Yeah. And you know, he was saying, you know, he served notice. They're working on this stuff. They're paying PR flacks and hacks. The people at Bill Hicks, I played that clip a little bit ago. People at Bill Hicks said, just kill yourself. They're paying those people overtime to come up with tormented phrases in the English language that will make the continued devastation, degradation, and utter destruction of entire regions of the country palatable to America. So, for a while they got away with it because they just made it forgettable. But now the movement has gotten enough momentum behind it that it's hard to ignore. And they are losing the PR war. Folks like Massey and Consol and so forth.
I mean, Obama's. Back to Obama real quickly, his victory was disastrous for Sean Hannity, who was trying to dehumanize the guy constantly, and the way he was rehumanized himself and, you know, and all the popular support he got just really, it was Hannity's struggling right now. But
well, you know, the story came out about Combs calling it quit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And interesting little piece in the Chicago Tribune today by a fellow named Eric Zorn. And he asks, you're going to love this question. He says, I've long felt that Alan Combs was to Hannity what the Washington Generals are to the Harlem Globetrotters, symbolic opposition.
Right.
Hannity is quicker, louder, angrier, funnier, and more confrontational and self-assured than the comparatively mild cerebral Combs. Therefore, he's the dominant and more compelling half of the team. Now, here's the fun part. I'd love to see Fox News Channel audition some of the liberal pundits out there who'd give Hannity a good match every night. Ed Schultz, Mike Malloy, Randy Rhodes come to mind, Al Franken if he loses the Minnesota Senate race recount. And
yeah,
you would love to see something like that.
Well, and that's another interesting thing about what happened with the Obama campaign. Obama called Hannity out. a couple times, and so did a couple people at Trinity United Church. The pastor who took Wright's place when Wright retired, he knew that Hannity was and his agents were taping everything and going to try to use it against the church. And he was like, "We know you're listening, Hannity, or something like that." And then Obama said something about, "Yeah, I'd like to talk to Hannity, or I'd like to set him up with," I forgot who he mentioned, but yeah, they tear Hannity up in a debate. I mean, people like, activists like Kevin Donaher and just so many people who could get loud with Hannity, get loud back. And Combs, I understand that criticism, but still, I must say, when I really paid attention to him, looked again, respect, I was impressed with a lot of what he was doing. And he was doing it under really difficult conditions. He was getting on his own radio show, which was on, like 20 stations around the country, he would get just deluged with calls from these Hannitized bullies,
yeah,
these vicious people. And he's just like, so for 3 hours, he's just like, and he's got open lines. And I'd call in and try to show some support or change the tenor of the discussion or change the issue, whatever, or throw it back on these Hannitized people. And it's like, you can get in. And that's, we could criticize Combs, but we have to take some responsibility ourselves as liberals who have been so passive for so long.
Well, and I think that's why Combs was selected in that scenario, Preston. He represented, Alan Combs represented the kumbaya-istic wing of progressivism and liberalism. I mean, he's got good ideas.
Yeah.
But because Hannity was the blustering horse's rear end, the Combs was left appearing to be a doormat because he allowed himself to be shouted down.
Yeah. I think some people were impressed by Hannity's bluster. I think others quietly appreciated a lot of Combs' positions. Combs' book, actually, also, he prints some of the emails he's received from some of Hannity's thugs, and they are death threats. I mean, vile, vicious things you can imagine.
Well, I mean, even in my little experience with terrestrial radio in America's fifth smallest radio market, I got on-air death threats.
Okay.
Maybe we ought to shoot you, Kincaid.
Yeah. And in Combs' book also, actually, he cited Noam Chomsky, a really powerful quote at the beginning of one of his chapters. It's something about the subservience of the elements of the media to elite power. And I was like, right on. But before I let you go, though, I very much want to hear your other callers and stuff. But I did want to mention two things real quickly.
Okay.
C-SPAN last week, it was disappointing in a lot of ways. They spent like 2 hours at the home of David Horowitz. I'm like, oh.
Charming.
The guy who spent much of his career.
And here's my conservative bathroom, and here's my, yeah.
Yeah, much of his career has been working to defame and discredit Noam Chomsky. He has a whole book called The Anti-Chomsky Reader, filled with the most scurrilous crap you can imagine. But anyway, they did recently have Jeremy Scahill and Naomi Klein on a panel, and they took calls. They were talking about Afghanistan, and I just caught the tail end of it, but whatever they said really moved the audience, and the calls they got were really interesting. And but they also were at they made a short visit to the West Virginia Book Fair.
Oh.
And they spoke with an author who wrote a book called Monongah.
Yeah, that would be David McAteer.
Yeah, yeah. And so there were those moments where even West Virginia represents. And
we get out there a little bit now and then. And Monongah, for those who are interested in things like labor history, Monongah is a brilliant book, and David McAteer is a brilliant man.
And he's from West Virginia, I understand, or was a columnist there or something?
He has. I'm not sure exactly what his educational background is, but he's got significant West Virginia contacts. But moreover, more importantly, he is the expert in mine safety.
Yeah.
And he's the one who was called in to investigate the outcome of both the Aracoma mine tragedy and the Sago mine tragedy.
Okay.
And is the go-to guy on how to run a safe mine. And of course, that means he is despised by folks like Massey.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. These heroic struggles taking place, you know, oftentimes, right in our midst. And I think he mentioned he had family. He had uncles and maybe a father in the coal mines. I may be misremembering.
Well, Monongah was a horror, and we also just marked the anniversary of the Farmington tragedy. And Farmington is what brought about the, and I mentioned this a little bit last night, Farmington is what brought about modern mine safety regulations, regulations that the coal industry hate to this day, and which at the time even the UMWA didn't want. The UMWA fought its own membership. The guys who didn't go into the holes anymore actively fought against the people who did. That's how bitter it was, and the UMWA rank and file went on strike, not only against the companies, a wildcat strike, not just against the companies, but against their own union.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me that doesn't take guts. But Farmington was the impetus for a lot of that, and it was a horrible tragedy. And I guess 40th anniversary this past weekend.
Yeah, and you know, I think, you know, we've passed some other anniversaries. They had a mining accident in Mexico, I think about a year ago, and about 90 people were killed.
Yes, and that barely a blip on the radar.
That's right. I mean, they'll cover it if it's terrorism. It's 24 hours a day, nonstop, filled with oversimplifications, of course, no context and history or anything like that. But anyway, just oversimplify and try to frighten people with it and da-da-da. But skip these huge mining accidents that have everything to do with very much connected with us, you know, because we're either transnationals that are based here or working there, or they have, you know, subsidiaries or proxies doing it for them. They're creating the markets for the product and smashing the markets that are the alternatives, you know, the solar. The car industry actually was exposed very recently on Democracy Now! About their role in blocking the electric car. You know, they've got these people sitting on these interlocking boards of directorate. You know,
oh, sure. It's nepotism and incest, and it's amazing that the board members of the big three don't all have big ears and buggy eyes. They're so inbred.
Great. One last thing, Bob.
Sorry, I do that sometimes.
But I wanted to mention a book.
Yes.
Again, to kind of challenge the perception we have that this is a center-right nation, damn it. Don't let your eyes...
Sing the horse vessel song! Sing the horse vessel song!
In this book, it's called Progressive Nation, a travel guide with 400-plus inspiring landmarks and left turns.
Oh, neat!
It is neat. It is neat. And on the back, the little description says that you'll visit battlegrounds and celebrate the victories of the civil libertarians, feminists, African-Americans, gays, lesbians, environmentalists, labor organizers, and media activists who have worked to create a more just, peaceful society. And it shows and gives the history of places like the home of abolitionist Levi Coffin and one of the movers behind the Underground Railroad, Alice's Restaurant Church, the namesake of Arlo Guthrie's song.
Which we will be playing later in the evening, yes. It's a Thanksgiving tradition.
The courthouse where Susan B. Anthony went on trial for attempting to vote, and the former camera shop where Harvey Milk launched his campaign to become America's first openly gay elected official. And it goes state by state and gives like six or seven examples of, you know, progressive history in our states, what we have accomplished. You know, so many times we're focused on the federal level stuff too, but, you know, hooray for Vermont and hooray for our, you know, predecessors whose work we're picking up on and hopefully we're honoring their work in some way. But moving moving it forward. And I think your show does this, you know, speaking of media activism. So,
well, if we can just keep it going, that's all I want. If people are getting something out of it, that's the only reason to be doing this. And so far, what I hear from folks, Preston, people do get a lot out of what we're trying to do here, because I think it's a little bit different than what others are trying to do. I didn't say better. I just said different.
Yes. Yeah. Well, celebrate the diversity.
Amen. Hear, hear. And have a very happy Thanksgiving.
You do the same.
All right. Take care, Preston.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Preston is our staff optimist. I think that, yeah, that's a staff optimist. Head on Radio Network optimist. Preston calling from Colorado. And keeping things rolling. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita. Yeah, hey, how are you?
I'm pretty good. I was thinking I was going to have to hang up because I started smelling smoke.
Oh, no.
And I carried my phone with me. I was looking outside. It looks like there's something in the sky, like the sky is full of smoke, so I hope we're not having a forest fire.
Oh, dear. Is it dry down there right now?
If it's right, yeah. Yeah, it is dry. I mean, we've had some rain, but not enough, you know. They say we're always dry here. They always don't want to allow us to burn anything, you know. Or, of course, we're not supposed to anyway now, but anyway, people still do. But
well, I hope. Well, I'm glad it wasn't dinner burning.
No. No, I haven't started on anything yet. But by the way, I want to say, you know, Preston is amazing, isn't he?
He is.
He's got a lot of insight and knowledge, and expresses it very well.
Well, I look forward to our conversations, and I always enjoy the little door openings that he brings of stuff that I can go and investigate and read up on, because, you know, probably 95% that I of the information that I consume never makes it to the airwaves.
Yeah.
That's the way it is throughout the horn.
It's
a matter of self-improvement and a matter of, you know, the more you know, the better off you are.
Yeah.
Knowledge is power and all that stuff.
Yeah, you amaze me in that, you know, that's what really got me hooked on you was that one of the things was that, you know, I would say something and you knew what I was talking about. And a lot of times that doesn't happen. You know, just different things, you know, that.
Sure.
And I was amazed at your fount of knowledge.
Sometimes the fount runs dry, trust me.
Yeah. I want to say something before I forget it. Barbara Walters is interviewing Obama and his wife tonight. I think it's on at 9,
mm-hmm.
9 o'clock, game boys. Listen. She was giving him really good words. She said they were amazing, you know, so they were so sweet together. She said, I'm not supposed to be partial, but she said I can't help but say, you know, how impressed I was with them.
Is this a standalone interview or is this?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was going to be real upset if she was pairing the interview with them with that interview she's doing with that obnoxious junkie Limbaugh.
Oh.
Because he's one of her persons of the year, and they'll have a segment on. Okay.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I don't get that. But she was talking about how shy he was or something. Somebody was talking about how shy he was in person at one time.
Mm.
Anyway, what I wanted to say was you were talking about saying things, you know, instead of keeping it, you know, all cheerful and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, as I was saying, you know, that there's so many things that took me years to learn, but one of them was that we do need to speak out or get upset about things going wrong. And one thing that I really, and I've said it before, but I'll say it again, that to me, one of the worst things that has been done in this country would be Nancy Pelosi not allowing us to impeach the guy, because look at all the destruction he has done.
History, Juanita,
since since 2006.
Yeah, right. We scarcely have the memory anymore to remember the bad, evil, wrong things that he did early on.
Right. There's so many things. And I really believe that, and also she would say she wasn't going to give him money, and then they ended up, you just can't believe it.
Yeah, I if there's any justice in the world, whenever it comes time to put up their monument or tombstone or whatever, with both Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, it will say, found wanting.
Yeah. And also, next to that is the press, of course.
Oh, without a doubt. For the run up the run up to the war and the cheerleading and the rah rah, because I don't know why people don't talk more about this, Juanita. The media, the for profit media, and this is one of the reasons that little seed grew in my brain of for profit only, as opposed to just being for profit. Everybody wants to make a little profit here and there. Nothing wrong with it.
Uh-huh.
But for profit only. The American media establishment had a howling conflict of interest. It was good for their paper sales. It was good for their TV ratings. It was good for us to start a war. You know, the New York Times cheerled this war.
Uh-huh.
They cheerled this war in an effort to raise newspaper sales, and they did it on the backs of little bombed, blown-up children in Iraq.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I saw a cartoon today that just showed a blank tan wall with a bloody handprint, and it said, Happy Thanksgiving from the children of Iraq.
Uh-huh. Well, to me, now, if they don't do something about these people, well, namely Bush and...
But they aren't gonna, Juanita. They're not gonna.
Well... If somebody doesn't, why should we do anything to anybody? The worst murder is not as bad as George Bush has been.
Jack the Ripper didn't do nearly as many. Charlie Manson didn't kill didn't kill as many people as George Bush.
Right. Ted Bundy. I mean, you stop and think about it. These are thousands. The blood of our servicemen and servicewomen, the destroyed lives, the chained, the disabilities, the children, all God's children, the little Iraqi children, you see them blown up, or like one little boy lost his whole family and he lost his legs and arms.
Yeah, I know. I've seen the photographs.
And, I mean, that's just one.
Meanwhile, look what's going on in India as we speak right now,
yeah.
Juanita.
Yeah.
The Obama team came out and they offered a statement on what's going on in India.
Uh-huh.
They said, let me see if I can find it here. President-elect Obama strongly condemns today's terrorist attacks in Mumbai, and his thoughts and prayers are with the victims, their families, and the people of India. These coordinated attacks on innocent civilians demonstrate the grave and urgent threat of terrorism. The United States must continue to strengthen our partnerships with India and nations around the world to root out and destroy terrorist networks. We stand with the people of India, whose democracy will prove far more resilient than the hateful ideology that led to these attacks. That's the Obama team. You know what George Bush did while the attacks were going on?
Probably play golf or something.
No, he pardoned a turkey.
Oh, okay.
And, of course, there was for-profit-only media coverage of it. It was broadcast live on CNN. The White House proudly announced that George Bush would be issuing his final Thanksgiving turkey pardons in the Rose Garden to pumpkin and pecan.
He had some kind of a press thing today, but I turned it off. Secretary of the Treasury, I mean. And I just turn it.
Has a nation ever, there are the weirdos, Juanita. And the weirdos are out running around buying guns like we heard about earlier.
Oh, my gosh, I know.
And hollering secession. the weirdos are doing that, but the rest of the nation, the normal people, have you ever witnessed a nation so anxious to see the end of a presidency as this and the accession to power of a newly elected president as this country is, waiting for Barack Obama to finally take office and start trying to do something?
Yeah.
George Bush, at this point in time, doesn't care. I mean, to call him a lame duck is to insult the duck.
Yes.
he's a lame slug. He frankly doesn't care. I mean, if somebody brought him a fiddle, he'd put on a toga.
Oh, he's been doing that. That's been my belief all along, you know, that he's worse than Nero ever thought about being.
The only thing they're interested right now is stealing what's left to steal.
Yeah.
And frankly, that's one of the reasons that I say, and I say this with real caution, I want, you know, I think if we're going to bail out Wall Street, then by golly, we can bail out some, we can bail out the employers of some hardworking union folks in the auto industry.
Yeah.
And if we're going to do that, let's not let George Bush do it.
Right.
Let's handle it when it can be handled with intelligence, right, with forethought. You know, the Bob Woodward wrote that book about George Bush, and he said that he did not like having policy meetings. He didn't like debating issues. He didn't like being briefed. In other words, he didn't like being president.
Right.
But because he's got that weird psychopathology going for him, Juanita, where he's mm-hmm. gotta get better than daddy. I mean, Dr. Freud would look to the heavens and say, "Oh my God, you sent me the ultimate case."
Yeah.
Sigmund Freud could have spent a lifetime analyzing the weird, twisted relationship between George W. Bush and his mama and his daddy.
Yeah.
Because it's there. And, George Bush said, you know, at one point in time, earlier in his life, they said, you know, what is it you'd really like? Well, I'd really like to be commissioner of baseball. And, fine. Yeah, if you could build a time machine and go back and let him be commissioner of baseball and not screw up this country,
yeah,
I would sacrifice Major League Baseball on the altar of saving this nation.
Oh yeah, yeah. Before I go, can I just say one thing? I don't know if
you can say anything you want, Juanita.
I don't know if you have any listeners from India or not, but I'm sure there's some that know people there, and I just want to send out my deep felt sympathies for the people there.
Hear, hear.
And know that there are people over here who care for you, and bless the people that try to help we the people. You know that people that can't help themselves.
Sure.
And anyway, I don't know if I said it very well, but anyway, I do have people that I know from India. I have one Indian doctor now. These are great people. They're people. We're all people, you know. And
simple concept, tough for a lot of people to wrap their minds around.
Yeah, a lot of people. And like my friends just say, well, I want a Christian, and I want someone who can speak English, and I say, I want somebody that knows what they're doing. So I said, I don't care if they're an atheist. I don't care if they're from another country, as long as they know what they're doing. That's what I want. But some people don't know what they're missing.
I know.
I've had many blessings in my life from knowing people from overseas.
Hear, hear. Yeah, look, and that's the thing. There's no such thing as overseas. It's still the same planet.
Right.
Yeah. Now, when we get to the point where we're talking about knowing Martians or something like that.
Yeah.
Or,
I've
you know.
Like that.
I don't know. The Mormon missionaries from the planet Kolob or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Or Xenu or, you know, planet Blorp. Then we'll start talking about differences. But we have no differences. The DNA strand in a person from Mumbai is no different than the DNA strand of a person from Bogalusa, Alabama.
Right.
It's just human.
Right. And we just, it's just a blessing. I'm so thankful for civil rights actions over here, and I think, what a disgrace for it to go on as long as it did, you know. And I've got a lot to be thankful for, I tell you.
We all do. Right? We all do. If you spend enough time thinking about it, Juanita, we all do.
Yeah. And, you know, they want to get rid of all the people that want to do good over here.
Oh, yeah.
They're trying to destroy the legacy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Sure.
They did kill Kennedy. They killed Martin Luther King. And you look at those people. Those people wanted to help us. And
they understood their place on the planet as being members of the human race.
But look at all the people that have been murdered for what they wanted to do to help people.
Isn't it interesting that, Hitler died by his own hand?
Yeah.
Stalin lived to some sort of an old age and may have finally been bumped off. But mostly it's the good who get the assassin's bullet.
Because
or the crucifix, or the noose.
The evil cannot stand the truth.
No. No, and that's...
They hate the truth.
I hope the Secret Service is taking very seriously all this secession talk and all this I'm going to buy more guns because of Obama talk. You know, nobody's more zealous advocate on behalf of the First Amendment, Juanita, than what I am.
Uh-huh.
But you know what? When I see the National Rifle Association declare Barack Obama, who has not done a blessed thing in office because he has not yet been installed into that office, when that organization declares that man to be an enemy.
Right.
You know, not wrong, not bad, not evil or wicked, but an enemy.
Yeah.
Wow, you can't help but wonder if maybe... somebody ought to make a phone call to somebody at the NRA and say, you sure that's what you want to be saying?
They don't care. They have no concern for anyone but themselves.
I know.
Having their way, having their twisted way of thinking.
Well, Juanita, I tell you what, I hope you and your son have a lovely Thanksgiving Day dinner. And I'm sure it's going to be tasty.
Yeah, I hope so. The way I have to cook, it's like camping out. I've learned a lot of different ways of cooking, because of not having things. And I found out, you know, I don't need a lot of those things. I was raised without them and I don't need them now. You know, the big old stoves and all.
Sure, yeah.
If I was cooking for a crowd, I would, but you know, I've learned to really use what I have and know that I don't need to get some of the things anymore. So I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
Not specifically, but you come from that stock who knew how to do good things with few things.
Yeah.
And so I do know what you're talking about.
But I thank you so much, and God bless you and yours. And
well, bless your heart, Juanita, and
All of our ELO, bless her, and I hope she's doing well.
And she's in the chat room, of course, and just all of us getting along as best we can, Juanita.
Okay.
You take care, and we'll be back at it come Monday.
Okay, dope.
All right.
Easy.
Bye now. They're in Florida. That's Juanita. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello there.
Hey, Dave, what's up?
Oh, I'm listening, you know, and making my little list as usual as things happen. You know, you were talking about coal earlier.
Is it still a little list or is it a long list?
Well, you know, it depends. Lists can get complicated once you start discussing them, you know. You were talking about coal earlier, and for me, the thing about coal is that really what coal is the Earth's carbon sequestration from about 100 million years ago.
Exactly.
So how can digging it up do any good? No, I mean, how? And how can you get energy out of it and then jam it back in the ground without doing any damage? It's nonsense.
Well, it's the least efficient of all the carbon-based fuels, from oil to natural gas to...
oil's got a fair amount of hydrogen in it, and so's gas. Coal's carbon, basically.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's problem number one. The thing that I try to keep a perspective on, Dave, is that as far as coal is concerned, it's not going to go away tomorrow. But how they go about getting it does not have to be as destructive as what it is. I personally think that we should start, especially in places that live and die by it, like West Virginia. The coal industry lies and says, oh, there's 500 years of coal in the ground. No, there isn't. I got a photograph I could show you of the seam of coal that Massey is going after on Cayford Mountain. It's 6 inches thick. Okay? There was a time when we underground mined seams 8 feet thick.
Oh,
12 feet thick.
In Canada. God.
Yeah. But they're blowing up mountains for seams of coal 6 inches thick.
Mm-hmm.
That shows you how little is really left in this state. And what's going to happen, and you know, for the people who think that coal's the neatest thing since Wheaties, fine, think that. But you know what? It is still a finite resource, and you'd better be prepared for what happens when it's gone.
Exactly.
Because this state is dotted. Appalachia is dotted with little ghost towns that are little more than empty buildings now. And, you know, once upon a time, oh, they boomed. They sure enough boomed.
But they bust, too.
But they bust. And that's what we've got here in West Virginia. It's a boom and bust and bolt for the border mentality as far as the coal companies are concerned. Because when they run out, they shut down and they leave. They don't stay around, Dave, and say, well, you know, let us transition you into a new green economy. No, it's screw you.
Yeah, exactly. The corporate way. Screw you. We got what we wanted out of you. Now we're gone. Bye. Have a nice life. If you can, with what we've left you behind.
Yeah. Careful of those sludge dams there. They may not hold forever.
Mm-hmm. And all that nice stuff that might be seeping into the water table.
Yeah, good luck finding us after when the hits the fan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, but there will be longer.
But see, these false...
On the beach, sipping a drink, saying, oh, isn't it a shame? All those
Or Don Blankenship, you know, taking his little hand-picked Supreme Court justice and going to the French Riviera like he did with another West Virginia Supreme Court justice.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, that's the thing. Whatever the resource is, when you build a world around it and don't think of what your world is going to be without it, then you're set up for disaster. Because if you look through history, Dave, and you know this probably better than I do, if you look through history, any time that you've had a hard transition out of one form of economy into another, therein lies social collapse and frankly, dark ages and all kinds of stuff. Rapa Nui comes to mind.
That's the only time any significant change ever happened, when that kind of stuff happens.
And the thing is...
And really, I think we're staring down that barrel right now.
But can we not wise up, Dave? Can we not wise up?
Exactly. There's two ways of looking at it. If all this stuff that's going on right now with the wealthy who wish to control the deal, if they manage to somehow shore this up and keep economies growing, they kill the planet. This is not just an economic problem right now. We're hitting two together. And unless they're both approached together right now, we're done.
Toast.
In my life.
Yeah.
Done. It's only a matter of time, you know. It's all over bar the shouting, as they say in England, you know.
Now, we say that here in the hills, too, Dave.
Yeah.
But you're right. And while the right wing's out there gunning up, I guess I want my side of the debate to be out there braining up.
Absolutely.
Because there's nothing in the world that says that we can't have green energy sources, that we can't begin to build a green economy while the old, tired, worn-out, coal-based economy is fading away. Because it's going to fade away. They ain't making any more for the next few hundred million years.
Not till humans have done, anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we might, you, me, us, we might be coal someday, but it's going to take a while.
Yeah. And a lot of pressure, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, I think I said this to you once before. I this all flagged for me just from the logic when I was 12. Economies cannot grow forever on a finite planet. Simple. It's not complicated. I think that's a really simple.
Well, it's almost Einsteinian, isn't it? Because there was the debate as to whether or not the universe was expanding or the universe was contracting or whether the universe is expanding and contracting. And that last model, that's kind of like breathing, isn't it? But what
all kinds of things.
Yeah, but what we have here is an economy that is predicated on nothing but pure expansion. Well,
yeah.
any kid who's ever blown up a balloon knows what happens when constant expansion is applied to a finite surface.
Exactly. Or if you have a finite resource and you just keep sucking it out faster and faster. Let's think. Ever run out of gas?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the mind-boggling thing about all this for me, is that it's so simple. How is it that people's eye have been pushed, so, you know, kept so nicely off the ball, that they're just falling into the corporate trap? Because that's really what it is. I joke with people. I've had a beard for 20 years. My kids have never seen me without a beard. And I always say my joke about the beard is, okay, here's my logic for a beard. 10 minutes a day, 365 days a year, that's 2.5 days a year. I've had this 20 years, that's 50 days, that's 7 weeks of my life. And I didn't spend a fortune on razors and shaving gel. You know, keep it simple.
Sure.
Don't feed the monster. I mean, the shaving game is a billions of dollars industry.
Yeah, but see, I let the beard go, and as John Fox once noted, I look like a Viking gone to seed.
Well, I don't, you know, for me it's practical. It's a short beard and I have short hair. For me, it's just super practical. I get up in the morning, I have a shower, I'm done.
Exactly, exactly. But that wasn't all that was on your list, right?
No, there's always more than that. You were talking about the big three. You know, rescuing the big three. It's interesting that the big three have to come up with a plan and present a plan to everybody before they get any money. But the banks, did they present any plan, or did they just say, give us the money or else?
I think it was the latter and not the former.
I think so. And the interesting thing about what I think is going to happen here is the auto industry will come in with a plan, and that plan will involve laying off millions, rehiring at lower wages, getting rid of health benefits, pensions.
Now, see, they do that, and that's where we say no. That's where we say, no, I'm sorry, if you're going to screw the workers anyway, you can go bankrupt.
But will the people at the top do that? I don't think they will. I think that's what they want.
Well, I think to the extent. Well, right now the Bush administration's just willing to. Well, not just willing. They want to watch the auto industry go bankrupt because. And what they're doing in these last 54 days or so is providing cover, Dave, for the auto industry to go bankrupt, screw people out of their pensions. Those, you know, I hate that phrase, legacy costs. Kiss my butt, legacy costs. Those are human beings.
Exactly.
Okay. But they're providing with the shilly shallying and dilly dallying. They are providing cover for the auto industry to go bankrupt and thereby destroy. The last bastion, last strong, unified
exactly.
Bastion of organized labor.
Yes.
Now, I would rather see the Obama administration come in and lay down some ground rules and say, we're willing to help, but you're going to get the help on these terms. And frankly, if you look at the fiduciary roles that corporate executives play within the corporate scheme, if you offer anything reasonable that allows the possibility that the shareholders won't get screwed, then you have to take the deal, even if it means laying down some tough guidelines. Now, to answer your question, Dave, do I think that the people in charge right now would be willing to stand up for working Americans? Oh, hell no. Do I think there's a chance that someone in the Barack administration, the Barack Obama administration, would do it? Yes, I think there is a chance.
I won't ask you to qualify how large. I think that would be a bit unfair, but it's one of those things. I hope to be able to hope. You know, I the election night, you know, I got kind of woohoo, this is looking kind of cool, and the size of the win and all that stuff. And I kind of got caught up in it, but I'm right now really backing off that point. Just the more, you know, you've got Clinton, you've got Gates staying in, you've got Rahm Emanuel, you've got all these people that are just.
And yeah, but you can even rationalize Gates.
Rationalize, yeah.
I mean, the guy was opposed to George Bush's fundamental plan for whatever he calls what they're doing in Iraq now. And
was there a plan?
I don't know what their plan was, but he opposed it.
I don't think there was one.
He wanted to start talking about getting out.
Mm-hmm.
Gates did. Yeah. Now I don't trust him because he's one of those old CIA creeps.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you can make an argument that given the situation on the ground, changing horses in midstream is not wise any more than maybe. And that's why things like the Joint Chiefs of Staff here are set appointments, so that a new president can't come in and just fire the Joint Chiefs or fire the Joint Chiefs chairman.
Surely in any sane world, though, if you're going to have a military, particularly one as powerful as the U.S. military, surely it shouldn't be down to one man. You know, there should be some kind of method whereby there's some overlap and there's a pair of them, so that there can be a smooth transition. Because just to keep one guy who's been in there forever, no one gets any experience, then all of a sudden he pops off. What do you do then? You know, it's a really kind of bizarre way of running the place, I think, is just a thought.
It is.
You know, given what we're talking about here, how enormously powerful and with such large potential for disaster, surely that reliance on one is not a good thing.
I don't see how you take issue with something like that. There's some things that are just fundamental issues of basic awareness, basic wisdom. I mean, I know that's kind of a squishy term, but wisdom, there's real wisdom out there, and you know what I mean.
Yeah, and the problem is that right now I don't see any of it being harnessed. That's one of the big problems that the Bush administration's had. There's been plenty of knowledge and plenty of wisdom out there, and it's been excluded left, right, and center.
Or, well, that's the way they defined it, though. They defined wisdom as the project for a new American century, people. They defined wisdom as William Crystal, all right? They defined wisdom as a guy who sticks his comb in his mouth to then run it through his hair, you know, Paul Wolfowitz. They, in short, the Bush administration, defined wisdom as cronyism.
Yeah, but nobody else did.
But nobody else was in the position that, you know.
No, but what I'm saying is, you know, the amount that was there that hasn't been harnessed is a crime. That's a crime in itself.
But, of course, you also know that if wisdom is some sort of quantum, that it exists outside the halls of power in the ivory towers. And with that being the case, you know, one of the things that's the heart and soul of the horn is the idea that we acknowledge and we revel in and we cherish and we try to bring out for extended conversation the wisdom of the people who are otherwise deemed by the for-profit only media, by the Republicans, by the hummingbird tongue canopy crowd, that we try to bring out the wisdom of the people who really have it, the people who are wise enough to survive in a culture that works actively against them.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's another question for you, and it goes to the heart of the Obama campaign, and that is, can the wisdom of the people who were behind him and got him elected, can that wisdom be harnessed on a local level? You know, it's that bumper sticker, think globally, act locally.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, for sure.
It's the heart and soul of the philosophy behind Kennedy's query, or Kennedy's the statement. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. See, thanks to right-wing media, Dave, we've gotten that all bass-ackwards for about the last 30 years.
I don't think we have anything to thank the media for.
Okay, well, not thanks, but as a how about a nice neutral, non-judgmental as a result of. Because they hear, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And the right wing has consistently hollered, oh, hell no. No, no. And it, you know, that top one-tenth of 1% who was the vast beneficiary of George Bush's tax cuts. No, no, it's time for, Muffy, it is time for my country to do for me. I need another tax cut.
Well, the thing is, it depends what you define as the country. I mean, is the country the people in it? You know, if you define the country as the people in it, then I have no issue with doing your best for the country. I have no issue there. But if the country is the corporate fiction, then I have a problem with doing something for your country.
I have a feeling.
How do you define your country?
Certainly, certainly. But I have a feeling we're going to see a dawning, I hope.
Oh, I hope.
Of that, of a new way of approaching problems and addressing issues that says that we no longer define patriotism or love of country by our willingness to go shopping. Of all the evil, hateful things that George W. Bush did and said in the course of these long, seemingly interminable, nearly 8 years, the most callous, the most cruel, and the most wicked and hateful was when he told us to go shopping.
Oh, I nearly fell off my chair.
From the smoking rubble.
I almost fell off my chair.
Of the side of the World Trade Center. And see, then like a dog returning to its, you know, he returned to it again. We, you know, the stimulus plan that came out last year, Dave, was, well, we're going to stimulate the economy, so we're going to send you $400, and we'd appreciate it if you'd go shopping. You cannot define patriotism. You cannot define any sort of sustaining love of country on consumerism. You just can't do it.
Well, we're back to environmental stuff again, because consumerism, again, is going to be the death of us all. You know, shop till you drop is, we'll all drop one of these days.
Yeah.
You know? There's no reason to make things that are so badly made that they fail in 2 years and you have to buy them again. An example, you know, my parents, and this is a bizarre example, my parents have a cheese grater that I remember from being a little kid. And I said that to my dad last time I was over in England. He said, you know what? I remember my grandmother having that cheese grater when I was a little kid.
See, we've still got that kind of stuff here, Dave. We've got 150-year-old iron skillets.
Yes.
I've got wooden spoons that were literally whittled by my great grandfather.
To make that was there once.
Yeah.
It wasn't then, you know, the carbon that went into the atmosphere when that was made happened once. Not 300 times because it was a $2 frying pan that still put as much out there but fell to bits in 5 minutes. You know, it's that mentality again.
Sure, yeah.
It's all part of that shop till you drop madness.
It is indeed.
It's all part of the same thing.
Well, Dave, I thank you very much. Of course, Canada celebrates Thanksgiving, in October?
Oh, long gone.
Yeah, October. So I won't wish you a happy Thanksgiving tomorrow, but I hope the one in October was a dandy.
Okay, it's pretty good.
And we'll be back on Monday.
Yep. Well, you have a great old turkey and, you know, enjoy, relax, and do all that stuff.
I will be probably sound asleep within 45 minutes of consuming the turkey.
Enjoy the family.
That's gonna. Take care. Bye.
Have a good one. Bye.
That's our buddy Dave in Canada. And rolling onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
It's Richard.
Hey, Richard, how are you?
Middle and fair. Don't know what else to say. I'm staggering around in my kitchen right now. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you well enough.
Okay. Am I overloading the board as usual?
No. Actually, you're not.
Okay. I moved the microphone. because I didn't want to do that. Well, you know, I usually listen to you delayed.
Right.
And the reason is, I mean, there are a couple of reasons. I listen to everything delayed. And I'm a classical musician by training, and I studied music for 22 years. And I'm very sensitive to sound. So often heavy metal feels like somebody just shoved hand grenades up my nose and set them off. So
I don't recall playing any metal lately, Rich.
Oh, really? Well, you know, just loud rock music in general.
Oh, okay.
So I fast forward through it, and I've recently realized that people aren't subjecting me to this music because they're trying to destroy me. You know, it's,
no, some of us like it, Richard. I know.
It's my problem. I like it sometimes. To be honest.
Yeah.
I just have a hard, you know, my own personal.
Oh no! I've got tics like that too.
But you know what
mine is, Richard? Mine is language.
Oh God, yes, and misplaced apostrophes.
It's there and there.
Yes.
Failure to comprehend the nature of the possessive.
Yeah.
Oh no, that's, trust me, if you were to sit down and talk to Agnes, she'd say, oh, he gets unbearable.
I know, and I'm an expert on turntables, and I'm restoring some right now. And, I'm on a bulletin board in France that is devoted to one brand of turntable, and we've got 1,300 members.
Oh wow.
You know, all over the world, and it's really exciting. Because the manufacturer of these turntables never did anybody a favor in that they did not put out any service literature. No repair manuals, ever. And so what a lot of us are doing is we're reverse engineering these machines.
That is positively medieval church thinking. You don't need an instruction manual. We'll tell you when you need to be informed.
Well, it is.
You don't want your own Bible. We'll read it to you.
Yeah, right. And they made, like the Swiss do, I mean, they made a very idiosyncratic machine. It's something that existed in their own heads, and they did a beautiful job of it. But here it is 30 years later, and we're all scratching our heads and modifying them and literally reversing them.
I just got to ask, what's the brand?
The brand is called Lenko.
L-A-N-K-O?
L-E-N-C-O.
L-E-N-C-O, okay. I'm not familiar. But, you know, there's a mindset that created that kind of stuff, Richard. One of the things that, I believe that it's gone into in several histories of the First World War, one of the things that the French, one of the problems the French had was they had a little interchangeable parts problem when the First World War came along.
In
that their guns didn't have any.
Oh. I didn't know that.
You know, meanwhile, on the other side, you know, the Kaiser's boys, a Mauser is a Mauser is a Mauser is a Mauser.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the French are idiosyncratic designers, and they can be really brilliant. And the Swiss are even more idiosyncratic.
Well, that's like German engineering on an automobile. If you don't understand how something is done inside a German automobile, it is not the car's fault. It is your fault.
Right.
It is your fault for not being able to think like a German engineer.
Well, that brings me to other aspects of stereo repair, because I used to do that. And I mean, it's one of the very many things that are on my resume. And you know, and this will sort of dovetail on something Dave brought up and you brought up in terms of products lasting. And by the way, I want to give an American product a plug right here.
Yes.
Can openers. I have got totally disgusted with cheap Chinese can openers that would self-destruct. They wouldn't even open a single can properly. And I finally went out and I bought myself a Swing Away can opener. This is made in the U.S. And it's just beautiful. They last.
No, the little thing on the hinge that you put next to the cabinet and it swings out of the way and
you've got
a crank handle.
Yeah, right.
And they last for about 1,000 years.
Exactly. And everybody...
It's really bad for the business model, Richard.
Huh?
It's really bad for the business model. You sell one, you never sell a second one.
Well, I just bought a second one because my the one I had for about 5 years stopped working properly. But I, after I bought its replacement, I discovered that I had somehow bent it. So I bent it back, and now I have two can openers.
Otherwise known as a user issue.
You could, yeah, you could say that. But it's nice. It's a, you know, it's a product that's made to go. And
well, why the heck do we, okay, here, let's transition this for a minute. What's wrong with a crank can opener? Why do we have to blow up a mountain? I mean, unless you have the physical inability to hold up a can and turn a little handle. And you know, that was one of those things that I like that next generation of, oh, wow, don't you love what we get into on this program? That next generation of can openers that instead of making the sharp little razor blade edge, it actually removes the whole can lid. And I've got a crank version of that.
That's what I have.
And I love that little thing.
Yeah. Well, this, what I bought, and now it cost me $8 at a hardware store. It's a pretty, you know, it's a big amount of money for can opener. But this is a handheld one.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing that you have, but you hold it in your hand.
Well, no, this is a handheld one that I bought as well. I was thinking of the one that was hanging at my parents' house through my entire life.
Yeah, so let's hear it for Swing Away.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, the thing is, I've had, now, you know, converting this over to cars, I've been buying imported cars mostly my whole life. And the reason is, as you might guess, the Americans just will not make a car that I want. And every time...
How is that defined, Richard?
Okay.
What makes you not want an American car?
Okay, first of all, I want a car that has seats that are contoured to my back and not some, you know, not some squirrel monkey's back.
Okay.
Actually, though, I have to say that GM has made some very good seats, and they're really better, in my eyes, than Volvo. Okay, first of all, the second thing is I want a car that is fixable.
Mm-hmm.
I want a car that can be repaired with no stupid cost savings. And right now I'm driving a Hyundai. My Hyundai has a drain plug on its torque converter. This is a very important little drain plug because it allows you to really change all the fluid in your automatic transmission.
Ah, okay.
Okay. Now, you listen to the guys on Car Talk, and they'll tell you that if you change the fluid in your transmission, your automatic transmission is going to last virtually forever. And I'm very good with machines. Things tend to last for me. But I want machines that are made to be, you know, that have some kind of...
that are maintainable and, in the case of needed repair, reparable.
Exactly. Where you don't have to take apart, you know, $1,000 worth of stuff to get it 1 5-cent bolt.
you just defined Detroit.
I did. I know. And but it's, see, it's not only in cars. It's like when the Japanese started cost cutting in stereo equipment, they did that with stereo components. Like, you know, my late bench technician used to scream about Sony. He cursed constantly about the way Sony designed their stuff because he couldn't fix it. And it wasn't technically because he couldn't fix it. You couldn't get at anything.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's not just Sony. That's I used to hear the same thing about a Zenith television set and microwave ovens. In the early days of the microwave oven, they had these, you know, these wonderful over-engineered bulbs in them. And when the manufacturing process was transferred to China, suddenly the tolerance has changed, and you're, you know, because it's, for a lot of people, Richard, they're not like you, and they're not inclined to go in and, you know, tinker around, and when it goes bust, well, it was only $75, so we'll go buy a new one.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know.
And there are mountains, there are literally, and we, you know, we never talk about, we don't think about, there are literally mountains of old stoves and old microwaves and old computers, mountains of them, in China. Because...
Yeah, you mean unsold?
No, junked.
Oh, junked.
And they go back to them.
Well,
And that's the consumer culture that Dave was talking about.
It is. There's a microwave, the head branch of a microwave oven chain. I bought a microwave oven that I wanted from them. It was, you know, I really had a hunt for it. I needed a large microwave, but one that doesn't use a lot of power.
Yeah, capacity as opposed to consumption.
Exactly. The reason simply is because I live in a funky old house and it has terrible wiring. So, you know, and I only found what I wanted from a Korean company. It's a Samsung oven. But wouldn't you know, the stupidest failure has taken place in the thing. The paint is all chipped off the inside. And it's rusted.
Yeah.
Imagine this.
I know.
The oven's fine, you know. But it's a rusty mess on the inside. But the Koreans, at least, have not, you know, their engineering, a lot of their engineering has been done here. And I think our engineers are more respectful of the end user.
Well, and because back in the day, the end user was the guy who was designing the product, among others.
Yeah, that could be. And I had, you know, from this bulletin board, I met with one of the board people from Hong Kong. He came to San Francisco for a convention. He makes medical equipment. And his point of view about the Chinese products is that they can make very good stuff. They'll make things to whatever standard the buyer wants. So, and I found this, by the way, many years ago when I was looking for a good, inexpensive receiver, stereo receiver for my customers. And all I could find out of the Japanese companies were, you know, crazy stuff with flashing lights all over it and dancing displays and all this stuff that, you know, who needs it?
I know.
It's down.
Hey, Richard, I've got to roll along here. We're running out of time, and it's the Thanksgiving program, and we got to do a couple of little rituals. But I love hearing from you, and I love talking about this stuff with you. I genuinely do.
Well, I'll get back.
Because I think this is a discussion that we're going to be having more of as we talk about the attempt to renew America's ability to do for itself.
Oh, yeah. It might be a union issue as well. But let me call you back. We'll continue on this car thing because
Absolutely, and I'd love your participation and the participation of others, because this is the kind of information, frankly, that our elected representatives and the folks in Detroit need to know. And we'll start the discussion here, and maybe it'll gather a little weight.
Well, hopefully, what I'm hoping is that the union guys can go to their bosses and say, "Look, we know what kind of car the American people will buy," because they don't.
No, the CEOs, yeah. All right, let's see if we can make a 2-mile-a-gallon SUV.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving to you, Richard, and good hearing from you.
Yeah, bye.
Bye now. There are two or three different things I do around the holiday season. I will put one of them off, story reading. I'm going to put that off until closer to Christmas because it's technically called a Christmas, it's technically a Christmas thing, but it happens around this time of year. Another thing is just to remember this night before Thanksgiving. The night before Thanksgiving that came to us many years back, not many, but several, when all of the children were considerably younger than they are now, and foolish me, gather around, kids, foolish me looked at my lovely wife and said, "Honey, let's go get the last of the stuff for Thanksgiving dinner." "Oh, I don't want to. Honey, let's not take these kids out. Come on, it'll be fun. This is family time." And so Agnes bundled the children up, and we got them in their car seats or their seat belts. One of those "Ma in her kerchief and I in my cap" kind of things. She put on her black leather overcoat, and I got dressed and put on my coat and stuff, and we set out. across the river to the local Kroger's. And, you know, as the holidays come on, grocery stores are absolutely awash with sensory assaults. And on busy-minded little children, I think it's a little bit like crack. It's sensory crack. And so we started making our way through the maze that the grocery store sets up for you. You know, down through produce, around past the mushrooms, on past the lemons and the limes, down to the meat counter. Funny how that works, isn't it? And then you make your way zigzag, zigzag, zigzag up and down the aisles. Agnes, in the course of raising our children, Agnes has shown very little tolerance for misbehavior in public places. And I don't disagree with her on it. Seeing somebody else's kids going nuts in a public place is sad and embarrassing, and in some instances understandable. But the two oldest in our crowd were, in our little tribe, were walking along with me, and I'd say, hey, grab that or grab that, and either Margie or Laura would grab it, and good as gold. But the two younger, who at that time, based on some characters in one of the Disney cartoons out, were referred to as Pain and Panic. That would be Ferg and Doodle. They got loose. And there's something about unimpeded, flat, straight space that drives a child mad with the desire to sprint, whether it's a school hallway or a grocery store aisle. And that's what began to happen. And I want this, and bringing stuff back to that. So Ferg and Doodle began sprinting the aisles. Agnes turned to me and gave me that look. That look that tells me that whatever she says next, I am certain to not disagree with, lest hell yawn open itself and swallow me whole. And she said, I'm getting the children. We're going to the car. Now, I've heard we're going to the car a number of times in the course of the growth of this little family. We're going to the car. We'll be in the car when you're done. Margie and Laura can stay with you because they're being good. But I'm taking these two. And we're going to the car. And the wailing begins. She grips one by one hand, uses her other hand to take the other's hand, and begins to march with them down the baked good, the baking needs aisle at the local Kroger. And you would have thought, you would have thought she was spanking them all the way. Oh, the wailing, the weeping, the gnashing of teeth. And so she's walking along with her black overcoat on, looking rather Matrix-ish. And they get within sight of the checkout counters where all the employees of the store are. And one of the two chimes in, lashes out, squeals, "Let go of my hand, lady. You're not our real mommy." You can only imagine the sweat condition alpha that transpired at that point. She continues to march them out to the car, puts them in, and I'm ignorant of all of this. I know nothing. Shop, 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 shop. Where are the marshmallows? Need some butter. Do we have the cornflakes? For the crumbs? Where are the canned sweet potatoes? Shop, 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 shop. We come out. We get done. We load into the van. And then I sit down and I look at my wife. and tears are rolling down her face. And I said, "What's wrong, dear?" "Nothing. Let's just go home." "No, really, what's wrong, honey?" I said, "Nothing. Take me home." Usually it takes three or four of these to... "Honey, please, tell me what's wrong." And then she explains that she had been visited by the local constabulary, who inquired of her as to whether or not those really were her children. A young guy and an older guy. Young guy, unmarried. Older guy, married with kids. "Can we see some ID, ma'am?" "Oh, you can see all the ID you want. Take me away. Go find their father. Tell him you're arresting me. I'll be fine with that. Three hots and a cot." And the young guy is not taking this to him. "Ma'am, ma'am, ma'am." And the older guy's just looking at her, kind of smiling. "Oh, God, I've been here. I know what this is about." So they eventually establish that Pain and Panic are, in fact, her children. And go away. And Agnes says, "So help me, I will never be seen in public with these two again." And they set up a wail. And the other two get upset, you know, they just the contact buzz of being upset, and the wail sets up. And back over the river we went, and the next morning got up and prepared our Thanksgiving dinner. But that is the perpetual Thanksgiving story. It will get like I said, it has the possibility if the children tell their children and their children and their children and on and on. This could become mythical. It really could, and I think it deserves to. But we wish to all of you the happiest of Thanksgivings. And we will, in fact, be thinking of you tomorrow. And we thank you, and we will be, as I said at the beginning of the program, especially thankful for the time that you choose to share with us. And so with that, we will wrap the program with that great Thanksgiving anthem. It would seem improper not to do so. So thanks to everyone. And with that, I offer you Mr. Harlow Guthrie and his account of the Thanksgiving Day Massacre. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
This song is called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's restaurant is not the name of the restaurant, that's just the name of the song. And that's why I call the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Now it all started two Thanksgivings ago. It was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving when my friend and I went up to visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice doesn't live in the restaurant. She lives in the church nearby the restaurant in the bell tower with her husband Ray and Bacha the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they got a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. And having all that room, seeing as how they took out all the pews, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, we found all the garbage in there, and we decided it'd be a
friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the city dump. Well, we got there, and there's a big sign and a chain across the dump saying closed on Thanksgiving. And we had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one. Till we came to a side road, and off the side of the side road was another 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile's better than two little piles, and rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning when we got a phone call from Officer Ogie. He said, "Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage, and wanted to know if you had any information about it." And I said, "Yes, sir, Officer Ogie, cannot tell a lie. I put that envelope under that garbage." After speaking Ogie for about 45 minutes on the telephone, we finally arrived at the truth of the matter and said that we had to go down and pick up the garbage, and also had to go down and speak to him at the police officer station. So we got in the red VW microbus with the shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, headed on toward the police officer station. Now, friends, there was only one or two things that Obi could have done at the police station, and the first was that he could have given us a medal for being so brave and honest on the telephone, which wasn't very likely, and we didn't expect it. Another thing was that he could have bawled us out and told us never to be seen driving garbage around the vicinity again, which is what we expected. But when we got to the police officer station, there was a third possibility that we hadn't even counted upon, and we was both immediately arrested, handcuffed. And I said, "Obi, I don't think I can pick up the garbage with these handcuffs on." He said, "Shut up, kid. Get in the back of the patrol car." And that's what we did. Sat in the back of the patrol car and drove to the, quote, scene of the crime, unquote. I want to tell you about the town of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where this happened. Here they got three stop signs, two police officers and one police car, but when we got to the scene of the crime, there was five police officers and three police cars, being the biggest crime of the last 50 years, and everybody wanted to get in a newspaper story about it. And they was using up all kinds of cop equipment that they had hanging around the police officer station. They was taking plaster, tire, track, footprints, dog snowing prints, and they took 27 8x10 colored glossy photographs with circles and owls and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. Took pictures of the approach, the getaway, the northwest corner, and southwest corner, and that's not to mention the aerial photography. After the ordeal, we went back to the jail. Obie said he was going to put us in the cell. Said, "Kid, I'm going to put you in the cell. I want your wallet and your belt." And I said, "Obie, I can understand you want my wallet so I don't have any money to spend in the cell, but what do you want my belt for?" And it said, "Kid, we don't want any hangings." I said, "Obie, did you think I was going to hang myself for littering?" Obie said he was making sure, and friends, Obie was, because he took out the toilet seat so I couldn't hit myself over the head and ground. And he took out the toilet paper so I couldn't bend the bars, roll the toilet paper out the window, slide down the roll, and have an escape. Obie was making sure, and it was about 4 or 5 hours later that Alice, remember Alice? It's a song about Alice. Alice came by and with a few nasty words to Obie on the side, bailed us out of jail. We went back to the church, had another Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, and didn't get up until the next morning when we all had to go to court. We walked in, sat down. Obie came in with the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back each one, sat down. Man came in, said, "All rise." We all stood up, and Obie stood up with the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures, and the judge walked in, sat down with the CNI dog, and he sat down. We sat down.
Opie looked at the CNI dog. Then the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and looked at the CNI dog. And then the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and began to cry, because Obie came to the realization that it was a typical case of American blind justice, and there wasn't nothing he could do about it. And the judge wasn't going to look at the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. And we was fined $50 and had to pick up the garbage in the snow, but that's not what I came to tell you about. Came to talk about the draft. Got a building down New York City, it's called Whitehall Street, where you walk in and you get injected, inspected, detected, infected, neglected, and selected. I went down and got my physical examination one day, and I walked in, I sat down, got good and drunk the night before, so I looked and felt my best when I went in that morning. Because I wanted to look like the all-American kid from New York City. Man, I wanted to feel like that. I wanted to be the all-American kid from New York, and I walked in, sat down, I was hung down, brung down, hung up, and all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things. And I walked in, I sat down, he gave me a piece of paper, said, kid, see the psychiatrist, room 604. And I went up there, I said, shrink, I want to kill. And I want to see blood and gore and guts and veins in my teeth. Eat dead, burnt bodies. I mean, kill. Kill! 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 And I started jumping up and down, yelling, kill! Kill! And it started jumping up and down with me, and we was both jumping up and down, yelling, kill! Kill! And the sergeant came over, pinned a nail on me, sent me down the hall, said, you're our boy. And you feel too good about it. Proceeded on down the hall, getting more injections, inspections, detections, neglections, and all kinds of stuff that they were doing to me at the thing there. And I was there for 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. I was there for a long time, going through all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things, and I was just having a tough time there. And they was inspecting, injecting every single part of me, and they wasn't leaving no part untouched. Proceeded through, and I when finally came to see the very last man, I walked in, sat down after a whole big thing there, and I walked up and said, what do you want? He said, kid, we only got one question. Have you ever been arrested? And I proceeded to tell him the story of Alice's restaurant, Massacre, with full orchestration and five-part harmony and stuff like that, and then all the phenomena stopped it right there and said, kid, did you ever go to court? I proceeded to tell him the story of the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one. It stopped me right there and said, kid, I want you to go over and sit down on that bench that says Group W. Now, kid! And I walked over to the bench there, and there's his Group W is where they put you. If you may not be moral enough to join the army after committing your special crime, and there was all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly-looking people on the bench there. Mother rapers. Father stabbers. Father rapers. Father rapers sitting right there on the bench next to me, and one, it was mean and nasty and ugly and horrible and crime-fighting guys are sitting there on the bench. And the meanest, ugliest, nastiest one, the meanest father raper of them all, was coming over to me, and he was mean and ugly and nasty and horrible and all kinds of things. And he sat down next to me and said, kid, what'd you get? Said, I didn't get nothing. I had to pay $50 and pick up the garbage.
said, what were you arrested for, kid? And I said, littering. And they all moved away from me on the bench there to carry up on all kinds of mean, nasty things. Till I said, and creating a nuisance. And they all came back, shook my hand, and we had a great time on the bench talking about crime, mother stabbing, father raising, all kinds of groovy things that we were talking about on the bench. And everything was fine. We were smoking cigarettes and all kinds of things until the sergeant came over. Had some paper in his hand, held it up, and said, kids, this piece of paper's got 47 words, 37 cents, 58 words. We want to know details of crime, time, crime, and else kind of thing. Got 17, 10 about the crime. Want to know the rest of an officer's name and else kind of thing. You got to say and talk for 45 minutes, and nobody understood a word that he said. But we had fun filling out the forms and playing with the pencils on the bench there. I filled out the massacre with the four-part harmony and wrote it down there just like it was, and everything was fine. And I put down a pencil and I turned over the piece of paper, and there on the other side, in the middle of the other side, away from everything else on the other side, in parentheses, capital letters, quotated, read the following words. Kid, you rehabilitated yourself. I went over to the sergeant and said, Sergeant, you've got a lot of damn gall to ask me if I've rehabilitated myself. I'm sitting here on the bench. I mean, I'm sitting here on the Group W bench because you want to know if I'm moral enough to join the army, burn women, kids, houses, and villages after being a litter bug. He left it and he said, kid, you don't like your kind. And we're going to send your fingerprints off to Washington, and friends, somewhere in Washington, enshrined in some little folders, and study in black and white of my fingerprints. And the only reason I'm singing you the song now is because you may know somebody in a similar situation, or you may be in a similar